The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, listeners and friends of The Heretics Hour. Thanks for joining me tonight on October 14th, 2013. Tonight's topic is the same as on my last two Saturday afternoon shows, Killing the Holocaust Myth. And this is part three. It takes a lot to, for some reason, okay, there it goes. It takes a lot to destroy this monstrosity called the Holocaust. And this new book by Carlos Mantogno, Thomas Cuse, and Jürgen Graf, titled The Extermination Camps of Action Reinhardt, contains a lot. And I am now realizing there may be many parts to this, as I have not even begun to get into the technical aspects, such as, could the alleged gas chambers have existed? What about the non-existent cremation facilities? The question of mass graves that have never been found, plus the quality of the witness testimony. However, this coming Saturday, I'm expecting to have Gunter Deckert as my guest. But as he is still on vacation, I've not been able to reaffirm as of yet, but he's pretty good once he sets a date. And the following Saturday, I may have a guest from England, so we'll see how it goes. Tonight, I will be continuing with the long chapter 5 that I was reading from on Saturday. It is the Führer order in the alleged National Socialist extermination policy. It's a long chapter, as I said, and so there is a lot that I didn't get to, and is going over more of it. I decided that I needed to spend, to continue with it to get some of this other information on the program, and so that's why I tend to think, well, okay, I've done enough in that, I should jump to go to another chapter, or I'll never get, to give an overview of all of this. But at the same time, there's another principle involved, and that is that if you just give an overview of this, that, and the other thing, many of you already have that overview, and you don't really get much out of it, and you don't really learn anything new. So I decided that I found this one part in particular that's quite long, but it's about a particular subject, and I just kept going and going with it, and I thought, well, I'll just take it to the end, because it's like a back and forth exchange, and that's what really shows us how this is developed, and really shows how every objection that the Holocausters raise or try to bring forth about their theories can be answered by the revisionists, and it is answered. So that's the way it's going to be tonight. And I want to make some points here. The main point in this in the whole extermination camp business is that there is no Führer order. This chapter is titled The Führer Order and the Alleged Extermination Policy. Well, there is no Führer order to exterminate all the Jews, though the reality deniers, I call them different things, continue to insist there was, because they need it to make their holo hoax reach the required level of evilness they demand. So they have substituted a verbal order told to various people like Himmler and certain Gau leaders. This they go to great lengths to deduce from selected out of context quotes over a period of time, as we shall see. So it's a fact that quite a bit of revision has taken place in the official narrative and is still taking place. There is no evidence, for one thing, of gas chambers or of buried bodies or of ashes. Instead, it's always promised that this evidence is yet to be found or unearthed. But they know it's there because the witnesses have said so, have told us. However, it's admitted that there were shootings taking place in the East after June 22, 1941, in the form of reprisal action and clearing out enemy nests of anti-German populations with criminal intent toward the Wehrmacht troops. They are called partisans and were largely Jewish. They certainly weren't totally Jewish. In some cases, they were vastly majority Jewish. In other cases, maybe not so much. But there were more. As we're gonna hear some of this in the readings tonight. Some instances of locally based mass shootings may have been made necessary because there was no way to hold and contain the groups that were arrested, no place to put them at certain times. And it is not therefore disputed that, it is not disputed that the program of the partisan war was outlined in the Soviet, from Wikipedia. The program of the partisan war was outlined in the Soviet People's Commissaries Council and Communist Party directives issued on July 29, 1941, and in following documents. Partisan detachments and diversionist groups were to be formed in the German-occupied territories, road and communications disrupted, German personnel killed, and valuable resources destroyed. Joseph Stalin, in his radio speech on August 3, 1941, reiterated these commands and directives to the people. Adolf Hitler, when referring to that speech on August 16, he referred to the speech of Stalin on August 16. Stalin's speech was on August 3rd, and he pointed out that the declared partisan war in the German rear had its advantages, providing the need to destroy, quote, anything that opposes us, unquote. Don't know if those were actually his exact words in the speech, but and that was a little piece from a Wikipedia page. So there were in the East effectively two wars being fought. One, with the uniformed Red Army, and two, with the local partisans, guerrilla fighters, who were not in uniform and who were in large part Jewish. So when you think about that, coming up with the idea of these killings and so on, you can understand, it's going to explain why so many were Jewish. But I also want to bring up right now that one of the problems with disputing the Holocaust, official Holocaust narrative, is the endless stream of false or out of context quotes that are stated, written, and published, all of which must be individually disputed, which takes an enormous knowledge of the literature and an enormous amount of time. The five controversial bloggers who, in a 540-page paper, attacked the work of Matonio, Graf, and Kues on the so-called death camps of Belzec, Treblinka, and Sobibor, plus Majdanek and sometimes Chelmo, I discovered that is the pronunciation, is silent C. I was thinking it was like a K sound, but sometimes I wasn't sure, so I used a CH sound, but it's just an H sound, but Chelmo, are practiced exponents of this method of constantly bringing out newly created distortions. So our three revisionists have stated that this is their last work on the subject, no matter what the five plagiarist bloggers come up with next, and have already moved on to their next project, which is the Einsatzgruppen activities against the partisan attacks mentioned earlier. All of this will come up in tonight's readings. So I'm starting with a portion from the chapter 5-4, Decimation by Labor. That's not too much from here, but some of this I thought was pretty interesting. I guess important to know things maybe that are not that well known. And did you ever think, you know, that they bring that up a lot. They want to get across the idea that that the National Socialists had the intention exterminate the people, and particularly the Jews, by making them work so hard. And so they always exaggerate and they lie about the kind of work they had to do and how they were treated while they were working. And of course, they didn't get fed hardly at all. And so this this hard work just killed them, killed so many of them. That was the point of it all. From an EM report that had no date, I'm going to take this from, this is what the person who is Jonathan Harrison presenting this to, accusing, in his rebuttal, in his response to, in their paper to what Carlo Mantogno wrote. And this chapter is by Carlo Mantogno. But this is, he's taken an events report, Einsatz Group and events report. They turned in regularly, I think daily, supposedly, these event reports, just, you know, on what was going on. And this one, he quotes this one as saying, in Western and Central Ukraine, jewelry is nearly identical with the urban stratum of workers, craftsmen, and merchants. An economic reconstruction of the Ukrainian administrative centers, as well as the development of the city administrative centers, will be nearly impossible if one were to abstain totally from using the Jewish workforce. There is only one possibility, which the German administration and the general government has misjudged for a long time, the solution of the Jewish question through widespread labor assignment of the Jews. This would cause a gradual liquidation of Jewry, a development which is in agreement with the economic conditions of the country. They had this discussion going between the economic needs, for which they needed as many workers, including Jewish workers, as possible, and then the other need to get rid of the Jews and kill the Jews. So that, you know, those two things were in conflict, and which way were they going to go? And Mantogno says this was in fact a recommendation. But he brings up an event report number 81 from 12th September. This one has a date on it, which displays a completely different perspective. So this is only something that was written, you know, it was sent in but it wasn't, that doesn't mean that it was accepted or that it was put into practice. And this other one from September, it says, after having noted that in certain areas about 70 to 90% of the Jewish population has fled, in other areas 100%, the author of the report comments, herein, an indirect success of the effort of the security police can be seen because of the self-deportation of hundreds of thousands of Jews, reportedly in most cases beyond the Urals, constitutes an appreciable contribution to the solution of the Jewish question in Europe. So in this case, they said that most of the Jews had gone east with the Red Army and were no longer there. So that was great because they were gone. So, but that, of course, wasn't the case everywhere. And here's where you have these different kind of reports. And you can't just take one report and say that is indicative of the situation and what was happening and what everybody thought. So, now, another quote here, and it's not really... Oh, the author of the report comments. This is his comment. Herein, it's the same... Oh, I already read that. Sorry about that. All right. Now, concerning the Jews and Poles, Harrison writes, yes, this is Harrison, writes, concerning Jews and Poles, further to the previous situation reports, it should be added that they work hand in hand with and assist communism and partisan organizations in every conceivable way. Hence, without a single exception, Jews and partisans are an identical concept. This was taken from a February 1942 Einsatz Group and report, and it does not, Mantogno says it does not make sense to claim that the equation Jews equal partisans had been established already before the invasion of the Soviet Union. But anyway, the point that this is interesting in that what's being said is that, the Jews and the partisans, the Jews and the Poles are basically these part what make up these partisan groups, and they are assisting communism. They are pro-communist, and so you know, they're all identical in concept. But some of this goes back to something I haven't read. I'm not reading from before, but Antonio is always claiming that he's claiming that these ideas about the Jews were not established before the invasion, that they learned about this, they equated the Jews with partisans after the invasion, because that's what they saw, that's what they experienced. And in the same context, Harrison adds, moreover, Bechtolsheim's order that Jews had to vanish from the flatland, this is a quote, vanish from the flatland, and the gypsies too have to be exterminated. And this Bechtolsheim was, you know, part of the, was a high level in the Einsatz group, and he ran one of them or something. I think this comes up in a little bit. But supposedly he had in one of his orders that he said that the Jews had to vanish from the flatland and the gypsies have to be exterminated. And this was issued, Harrison says, before there was any partisan threat in Bielorussia. Well, then Metonio gives us the full quote, and he says that Harrison got this from a passage in Christopher Browning's book, and he repeats it there, but let me see, I don't want to repeat this over and over again. I'll just go ahead with it. He said in Browning's book, it reads, moreover, Bechtolsheim's order that Jews had to, quote, vanish from the flatland and the gypsies, too, have to be exterminated was issued before there was any partisan threat in Bielorussia. Indeed, so the quote goes on, the part that Harrison didn't include. Indeed, the fact that gypsies also had to be exterminated shows that Bechtolsheim was using military prerogatives to carry out extermination of groups he defined by race. Now, the immediately following sentence says, this is Carlo Metonio telling us, is the implementation of larger Jewish operations is not a task for the units of the division. They are carried out by the civilian or the police authorities. Where appropriate, they are ordered through the commander of White Ruthenia, if special units are at his disposal or for security reasons and during collective measures, unquote. So Carlos writes, Browning informs us, Christopher Browning, this Holocaust author, informs us that General Gustav Freiherr von Bechtolsheim was the commander of the 707 Infantry Division deployed in the General Commissariat, Weiss-Ruthenian, White Ruthenia. And therefore, the document disproves the interpretation of Harrison. The alleged extermination order did not come from von Bechtolsheim, and his handling was not his competence. So it's saying that this this operation is not a part of the division, that it is carried out by the civilian police authorities in the area of White Ruthenia, and none of this came from the from Bechtolsheim, actually. But see how they it's hard for me to I have a hard time following it myself, but it's the point is that they take these quotes, or they take these reports and so on, and they pick around in them and they try to find things that are going to make something seem to be so that is not. Let's see, where did I leave off on that? Yeah, so Metonio goes on, for what concerns the document, the fact that the Jews should, quote, disappear from the flatland does not mean that they would have to be killed. The term flatland refers in fact to the rural areas in juxtaposition to the urban areas. This clearly results from the letter of Stahlecker of 6 August 1941. Anyway, it's going to be saying that they want to get the Jews out of the countryside and put them in the cities where they can have better control over them. And this letter from Stahlecker reads, the draft sees as the most principal drastic measure the cleansing of the countryside from Jews. On the other hand, Jews are to be forbidden to reside in localities that are of economic, military, or ideological importance, as well as bathing resorts and spa towns. Accordingly, only a small number of small or medium-sized towns would remain as future living space for the Jews. The draft foresees, and then a little space there, something left out, and then the draft foresees a resettlement from the countryside to the towns. Now, why would they want to do that? Because these Jews are big supporters of the Soviet, big supporters of the partisan activity, and if they're out in the countryside, they can really hide themselves and do a lot of damage. So they want to get them out of the countryside and into the cities, where they're at least concentrated in a place where they know they are. So makes sense. And also bathing resorts and spa towns would be places where they could do a lot of damage and mix in well with, you know, get jobs and mix in with things and then do a lot of sabotage and so on. So now Carlos, no, this is... Well, it says the issue of the Jewish question and the war economy, and a quote from Harrison, of course, regarding the urgency of the economic tasks in the East caused by the war, it has to be made sure that with all measures against the Jews, economic concerns will not be considerably harmed. This was said above, and I mentioned how they're talking about this quite a bit, which... And of course, it means that they need workers. So that's what they mean by economic concerns. And Matonia writes, Harrison's final statement, which confers a criminal semblance to the above-mentioned measures, remains to be examined. And this quote from wherever it's taken from goes on January 10th, 1942, Himmler confirmed to Rosenberg that measures to eliminate Jews shall be taken without regard to economic consequences. So it's as if a decision had been made that we've got to eliminate the Jews in spite of the fact that, you know, we need workers because it's more important to get rid of these Jews than to have, you know, try to utilize them as workers. This is what is being presented by Harrison, the blogger. Because he's always trying to show that however it's done, in every way, they wanted to kill Jews, you know, and as many Jews as possible, because they've got this huge number, you know, 6 million to reach. And so they have to be working at this all the time. And Matonio's main goal is to show that there was no plan and no idea to kill Jews just because they were Jews. Jews were killed for cause. There were reasons, and so that's what we go into a lot here. So he says the following quotation adequately shows the lack of critical sense and the gullibility of the Orthodox Holocaust historians. This is kind of a different topic here. I've got it separated with some asterisks. And this quotation is, in Ukraine, killings continued through the winter of 1941-42, as shown by the gassing of Jews with Lorpikrin to clear the Zlatopol ghetto in Nikolaev on the orders of the county commissar. All right. So this, they're saying that it's known that they gassed Jews with Lorpikrin as early as the winter of 41. Can't read that. And 41-42, that winter. And this is from Dieter Pohl, who is another Holocaust writer, you know. And from his, I don't know if it's a book, but The Murder of Ukraine's Jews Under German Military Administration and in the Reich Commissariat, Ukraine. And it was cited in Ray Brandon and Wendy Lauer's book, The Shoah in Ukraine, in 2000, published 2008. Remember, there's Wendy Lauer again. She's somebody I have to keep my eye on. And this quote is supposed to be damning. It is on 2nd February 1942, 202 Jews from the ghetto Zlatopil were eliminated by the militia on order of the district commissar through gassing with Lorpikrin. The elimination of the Jews could be carried out without disturbance and without causing a big stir. That's what it said. It said it was carried out without disturbance and without a big stir. So, Montonio asked, what is lorpacrin? He says, Paul did not investigate, and Harrison not even in the slightest. The subject is gassing, and this is more than enough. So Montonio did investigate himself. He's the one that has to investigate everything. And he says, actually, the term does not mean anything, as it is a simple error for chlorpicrin, which is trichloronitrile methane. And this substance was used as an aggressive chemical irritant during the First World War, and later as a disinfectant against nefarious insects such as weevils, lice, fleas, bugs, and as well as against rats. This gas has a relative density of 5.66 compared to air, and a boiling point of 112 centigrade, which means something if you know anything about chemistry, which I don't, so I don't know what it means, but he's putting it in there for a reason. It is known, however, that during World War II, chlorpicrin was not part of the most common and therefore most easily obtainable disinfectants, which included Zyklon, T-gas, Tritox, Ventox, Cartox. He describes what these things are, but I'm not adding that. And carbon, and nitrile, calcid, and cyanogas. All of these disinfectants were regularly distributed by the company Degesh, but not this chloropicrin. So he continues, given the above, it has to be explained how a simple district commissar, who was the one who was said to have done this, was able to obtain chloropicrin in a small village in Ukraine, located approximately 80 kilometers northeast of a town near Kiev. How he had used it for the alleged gassing, since its boiling point is 112 centigrade, and further, how the operation could have taken place without perturbance. That's what it said. It said it was, you know, real simple. In 1942, the hygiene department of the Royal University of Padua performed experiments to test the efficiency of various disinfectants, among them also chlorpicrin, regarding which it observed, and this is from the Padua study, the chlorpicrin presents some inconveniences. It is difficult to handle because of its lacrimatory effects, which means producing tears. I guess it's something, has something of an effect of a tear gas. Even if massively diluted, and it says if you dilute it 1 to 200 million, it's still very toxic. I find that very strange. But after finishing the operation, a lengthy ventilation of the room for 2 or 3 days is necessary because the lacrimatory effect persists for that same time. So Montonio says the ridiculous lorpicrin story is also referred to by Myers in Chapter 4 of the Manifesto. In other words, this is a totally unbelievable story. So I wanted to include that as a good example of what they do, and they get by with it. Because how many people who are just happen to come across or look at their books or whatever are going to investigate that in the way that Antonio did, because he knows to be suspicious. They're just say, oh, well, there's this a story that they gassed this only 222, but, you know, I mean, when you get into these huge amounts, they have to come up with, you see that these little amounts don't amount to much, but still, you know, people think, oh, 222 people. And they did it with this particular kind of gas. And so anybody could do it, which they couldn't. All right, I'm going to go now to chapter 5-7, titled The Local Exterminations. And it starts on page 300, or at least I'm starting on page 300. I'm not sure now which, but I will begin reading it. Montonio writes, Harrison here sums up the latest thoughts of Orthodox Holocaust historiography regarding the genesis of the extermination camps. The old historiography proposed in this regard only unfounded speculations, but they were at least chronologically coherent. The hypothesized Führer order was placed in a period previous to the alleged establishment of the extermination camps, for instance, at the end of summer 1941. That's what Hilberg said. The new historiography, with Gerlach at the helm, remember I talked about Christian Gerlach, Saturday, and I probably the Saturday before that too, maybe, is instead faced with a profound contradiction. That is, the construction of the Belzec camp began in November 1941, and the camp of Chelmno was inaugurated on 8 December, although this date is based neither on documents nor on testimonies. Therefore, the preparatory works for these camps, which would be blueprints, requisition of materials, staffing, preparations with regard to logistics, etc., must have started several months earlier as well. But Hitler's fateful decision was not claimed to have been taken prior to 7 of December. In order to overcome this contradiction, the new historiography, did you know there was a new historiography? Yeah, these people like Browning and Gerlach are creating it, had to invent the helpful concept of so-called local or regional extermination centers. Let's go back to Gerlach, he says. As is inevitable, he starts out from mere speculations. He writes, it is possible that the exchanges on December 13th and 14th described above led to a shift of personnel on very short notice, but it is also conceivable that at these meetings, Buhler, Rosenberg, and Himmler gave Hitler only information about the steps that had already been taken to exterminate the Jews using poison gas, that is, about the murders using gas vans in the Soviet territories and in Chelmno, and about the status of preparations at Belzec. You see how he's creating a scenario that he's just imagined, you know, that he's just put together because it fits his story. As Antonio says, obviously all is possible and everything is conceivable, but a historian should rest upon what is documented. Gerlach then tries to justify his speculations regarding the above-mentioned camps. And Gerlach writes, significantly, only 4 days before the Führer's decision, and independent of it, the first extermination camp at Chelmno had begun its grisly work. Arthur Greiser had literally received special permission from Himmler and Heydrich to execute 100,000 Jews. It is unlikely that Hitler was involved. If Greiser had received permission from Hitler, he would not have had to express his gratitude to Himmler, yet he did so. This is pretty amazing. This man is supposedly a respected Holocaust historian, and he's writing stuff like this, which, now this is what Metonio says about it. In reality, in his letter to Himmler of 1st May 1942, already examined above, Greiser did not express his gratitude to Himmler, but he limited himself to saying that the special treatment, Sonderbehandlung, had been authorized by the Reichsführer SS in agreement with Heydrich. It is unclear, however, why Gerlach states that the order did not come from Hitler, as this would be more logical and likely. Gerlach excludes it only because it contrasts with his thesis. Furthermore, nothing proves that this authorization referred to the opening of the Chelmno camp. In this case, he even contradicts himself by stating, and this is another quote from Gerlach, Arthur Eisenbach, Arthur Eisenbach, Operation Reinhard, mass extermination of the Jewish population in Poland, in Polish Western Affairs, you know, Eisenbach, here's the line, Eisenbach mentions an enactment by Greiser dated January 2nd, 1942, regarding liquidation of the Jews, Entjudung, in the Vartaland, liquidation of the Jews in the Vartaland, which is an area around Posen, now called, I had that. What is that in Polish? An area of Poland, not all of Poland, that wasn't Poland at the time. And the Warta River runs through there. So it's also called the Warta Land. So back to Metonio. In the mentioned article, what Eisenbach writes is, Gauleiter Greiser received a special order from Himmler, approved by Heydrich, to start the extermination campaign in the province and liquidate 100,000 Jews in the first months of 1942. In this connection, on January 2, 1942, Greiser issued a secret order to free the Wartgau of Jews. At the beginning of May, the same year, he reported to Himmler that this order would soon be carried out. Now, remember, Greisler, I think he's a Gau leader. Didn't they say he was a Gau leader? Anyway, he's a leader. He's the leader of that area. And so, but they're saying that they're finding damning statements from this Greiser about how they're, you know, have this idea to exterminate the Jews, and he's got this number of 100,000. Metonio goes on, please note the misleading translation in Gerlach's article of the term Entjudung, which is de-Judization, which can also refer to deportation, with the gorier word liquidation. He's confusing the two words, you know, instead of de-Judization, he's using liquidation in his translation. Isaiah Trunk informs us that we are dealing with a decree on the dejudization of the Wartgau of February, I think it is, 1942. And there's a paper there. That's the same one. And this decree has not been found, Metonio says. They're talking about this decree, but it's never been found, so they don't have it. We learn about it from Greiser's letter to the Lodz mayor, dated 13 December 1942. Now this next part is, no, this is Metonio. It is not serious scholarship to invoke as proof of something a document of which the content is unknown. That a priori order by Himmler would have existed, of which Greiser's order of 2nd January 1942 would have been its implementation, is pure speculation. Did I say that right? That, you know, that an a priori order by Himmler, according to what Harrison's trying to prove here, and Gerlach is actually writing about this, is pure speculation, Antonio says. Moreover, how could this alleged order be reconciled with the opening of the alleged extermination camp of Helmo almost 1 month later? Gerlach tries next to solve the contradictions relative to the Belzec camp. And he writes, it is possible, hypothetically, that Hitler had already announced his decision before a small... See, again, he's making something up here, hypothetical. Hypothetically, that Hitler had already announced his decision before a smaller circle at some point between December 7th and December 12th. Statements made by Eichmann, we're talking about Adolf Eichmann, After the war, he makes these statements, make this seem relatively improbable. On several occasions, Eichmann stated that Heydrich had called him in one day and told him that Hitler had ordered the extermination of the Jews. Two details of his account are significant. First, according to Eichmann, Eichmann's testimony is not reliable, but Heydrich had clearly gotten the information from Himmler. If a meeting had been held between December 7th and December 11th to allow Hitler to announce his decision to exterminate all European Jews before a smaller circle of advisors, it is difficult to imagine that Heydrich would not have been present and would have had to learn about the decision from Himmler instead. After all, Heydrich was in town until December 11th, so he was available to attend such a meeting. And it was Heydrich who had been given the commission to prepare the total European solution of the Jewish question. Second, Eichmann stated that he was sent immediately after his conversation with Heydrich to meet with Globochnik at the concentration camp in Belzec. Eichmann's descriptions of the status of construction at Belzec make it clear that his visit could not have occurred before December 1941. Most experts have declared this to be impossible since, according to their theories, such a date would be too late. Eichmann's more general recollection of being sent to Belzec immediately after an important decision had been announced would, however, be consistent with Hitler's having made his decision in December 1941. So, Montoya says Gerlach's first argument is a simple speculation without any documentary evidence to back it up. The second is an erroneous interpretation of Eichmann's statements. So, in basis, this is, you know, the attempt by Christian Gerlach to back up his idea that Hitler did give an order to exterminate all the Jews, and he gave it verbally to a group of people, including Himmler. And then things went forward from there. But so Metonio is having to look into all of this and see if it makes any sense. Then we have, I don't know if I should read all of this because I'm definitely going to not get to some of the more interesting things. So this goes on, says Metonio says, to summarize, Eichmann would have been sent to Belzec immediately after his conversation with Heydrich, who would have mentioned to him Hitler's extermination order. Since Eichmann's visit to Belzec could not have been prior to December 1941, the establishment of the Belzec camp is consistent with Hitler's decision in early December 1941. In this reconstruction, that's what Gerlach is trying to say. Gerlach omits the parts of Eichmann's statements which contradict his thesis. According to Eichmann, during the above-mentioned meeting, Heydrich communicated to him, the Führer has ordered the physical annihilation of the Jews. For Gerlach, this happened in early December. Heydrich then added, still according to Eichmann, Eichmann says Heydrich told him, go to Globochnik. Globochnik is the one who's blamed for a lot of things. The Reichsfuhrer has already given appropriate directives to Globochnik and see how far he has come with his project. He utilizes, I think, the Russian anti-tank ditches there for annihilating the Jews. See how they translate these things too, using the word annihilating when probably it's not, it's a different kind of a word. But, kind of lost my place here. Eichmann went to Lublin to see Globochnik and mentioned to him the order which he had received from Heydrich. That is that the Führer is said to have ordered the physical annihilation of the Jews. Afterwards, he visited a camp, perhaps Treblinka or another. He did not mention Belzec, however. He didn't know at that time what camp he was at. At the unnamed camp, the Jews were already poisoned with the exhaust gases from an engine of a Russian submarine. This was according to Eichmann. Now, during his interrogation later on, he said that he was sent to the same camp a second time in order to report to the head of the Gestapo, Heinrich Müller, and then he recognized the structure. The wooden house right on the right was still in my recollection. Left were several others, two, three other wooden houses, unquote. But this time he had no doubts about the name of the camp. He said, instead, I arrive at a station, that is, to a station named Treblinka. In the narrative published in the periodical Life magazine in 1960, Eichmann stated instead that the alleged massacre had taken place at Majdanek. You see how he's, you know, either he doesn't know or it's this place or that place, but it's not ever at Belzec, which would be the one that was first opened and would, you know, was ready for it. And then Eichmann's narrative, there's another quote from him, and it's completely inconsistent, Metonio says, with Gerlach's thesis, because on the one hand, Globochnik is said to have received an extermination order from Himmler, already before that, and Eichmann was then allegedly asked to verify how this order was being implemented. He was asked by his, the people who were questioning him after the war. I think during his trial, previous to his trial. And on the other hand, he supposedly conveyed the Führer's extermination order to Globochnik, who was already acting upon an even earlier extermination order given by Himmler! Exclamation point. So this is a confused story, to say the least. And he's, Mattoni says, Gerlach's argument would make sense if Eichmann had brought to Globochnik the order to construct the Belzec camp. But the German historian himself states that the, that means Gerlach, states that the construction of the camp had already started in November 1941 before Hitler's decision. Therefore, this camp, like Helmo, could neither have been established due to a local personal initiative by Greiser or Globochnik, nor as the consequence of a Himmler order without a previous decision by Hitler. Eichmann's alleged visit to Treblinka or Majdanek instead of to Belzec further tangles the question, not to mention his memoirs published by Life in 1960. In that article in Life, supposedly the memoirs of Adolf Eichmann, he says straight out, 1941, the Führer himself ordered the physical annihilation of the Jewish enemy. He added that soon after the order, Heydrich summoned him and mentioned to him Reichsfuhrer Himmler's order that all emigration of Jews was to be prohibited, with no more exceptions. But this order was given on 23rd October 1941, and therefore the alleged extermination order would have been given even before that. But it supposedly was in December 1941. So therefore the new Orthodox Holocaust historiography, Mattonio says, far from having solved the problem of the Führer order, has entered a dead end of unfounded speculations. But this is the work that these Holocausters do, that they say among themselves and seem to accept is proving their case, and they've got all this proof, they've got all this material and evidence and so on, even though it can be taken apart by someone like Carlo Mattonio. But unless somebody's reading what Carlo says and, paying attention to that, which very few are, then nobody gets that information. And that's how this thing, this big hoax and this big monstrosity of the Holocaust keeps going on. So on page 322, there's some more about, well, there's a lot. I might let this go for now. There's a lot of about the building of these camps and the dates that they give and when they were started and how they were, when they came online and so on, and how that works out with the so-called Führer order. So this is all more concerning the Führer order, but. There's one sentence here that I noticed. Thus, in a sense, it cannot be stated that the alleged extermination of 100,000 Jews could have been implemented without a previous extermination plan for the European Jews. So again, they end up trying to say that there was a lot of extermination going on, and there probably was some. There was some. Before there was the order and it became the plan to kill every Jew in Europe, to make sure that they could exterminate every Jew in Europe, which is what these bloggers want to claim, and so do these other authors want to claim still. So here's the unfit for labor stuff. I just don't know if you can really get all of this from me reading it. And so I'm going to move ahead just a little bit. All right, we'll get into still talking about Eichmann and all this stuff. But, Ribbentrop comes in on the scene. Ribbentrop, the foreign minister. And I'm trying to figure out where to start here. There's this man, Benzler, Luther. These are German, you know, officials. On 11 September, Luther replied to the German Foreign Office, to Felix Benzler at the German Foreign Office, that no approval can be given for the deportation of Jews into a foreign country. Okay, here, this is a good part. In September, 8 September 1941, Felix Benzler, plenipotentiary of the German Foreign Office, was sent to Belgrade to his ministry. He sent from Belgrade to the Foreign Office a telegram stating, it has been verified that Jews emerged as accomplices in many acts of sabotage and insurgents. It is therefore now urgently necessary to provide in an accelerated manner for the securing and removal of all male Jews. The number to be considered for this purpose may be about 8,000. At present, a concentration camp is under construction, but in view of the future development, it seems advisable to get these Jews out of the country as soon as possible, that is, with empty freight barges down the Danube River, in order to disembark them on Romanian territory or islands in the Danube Delta. I ask for the creation of the pertinent required prerequisites regarding acceptance on the part of Romania. And Luther in the Foreign Office writes back, no approval can be given for the deportation of Jews into foreign territory. In this way, a solution of the Jewish question will not be achieved. It is suggested to secure the Jews in labor camps and to use them for necessary public labor. And Benzler replied that accommodation in labor camps under current internal conditions is not possible because securing them there is not insured. The security is not insured. Jewish camps hamper and endanger even our troops. He writes, therefore, an immediate clearing of the camp with 1,200 Jews in Sabak is necessary because Sabak is a combat zone, and in the surroundings, insurgent gangs with the force of several thousand men have been identified. So these Jews are a real problem down there, and he added that the deportation of initially the male Jews is the essential prerequisite for the reestablishment of orderly conditions. Benzler then reiterated his proposal, if it were to be denied one more time, then only the immediate deportation to the general government or to Russia would be left, even though this would imply transport difficulties. Rademacher then involved Eichmann. He called Eichmann by telephone on 13 September, taking down a note of the discussion in which reads, according to information from Sturmbannfuhrer Eichmann, accommodation in Russia and general government is impossible. Not even the Jews from Germany can be accommodated there. Eichmann proposes shooting. Nonetheless, Ribbentrop, in a telegram dated 2nd October 1941, decided that it was necessary to get in touch with Himmler to clarify if he could not take over 8,000 Jews in order to bring them to eastern Poland or elsewhere. If Himmler could not do that. On 25th October, Rademacher summarized the decision taken. He said, the male Jews are shot until the end of this week so that the problem raised in the missions report is solved. Matonio says, regarding the remaining about 20,000 Jews, remaining about 20,000 Jews, women, children, and elderly people, as well as about 1,500 gypsies, of whom the males will also be shot if they had to be gathered in a ghetto in Belgrade where they could be fed during the winter. That is, they would be... The decision regarding the Jews was the following. Quote, as soon as a technical possibility exists within the framework of the comprehensive solution of the Jewish question, the Jews will be deported on the waterways to the reception camps in the east. So, in the meantime, the Wehrmacht, now this is, says, Harrison's argument is incomplete and misleading. I guess this is Harrison. In the meantime, the Wehrmacht, under the command of Boehme, began to shoot Jews under the pretext of the need to fill one for every 100 reprisal quotas. Such reprisals were not, however, for crimes committed by Jews, but were instead inflicted on Jews in lieu of Serb partisans who had not been captured in sufficient numbers to meet the quotas. And this is what Harrison is saying, saying that they were shooting a lot of Jews just because they wanted to shoot Jews, and they've had 2,000 Jews and 200 gypsies shot dead following the quota of 1 to 100 for brutally murdered German soldiers, and a further 2,200, also nearly all Jews, will be shot in the next 8 days. That is not pleasant work, but it must be done in order to make it clear to people what it means to attack a German soldier, while at the same time the Jewish question solves itself most quickly in this way. Actually, it is wrong, if taken literally, for that murdered Germans, for whom the ratio of 1 to 100 should come at the expense of the Serbs, 100 Jews will now be shot, but they are the ones we happen to have in the camp. So this is supposed to be all very damning, that they were shooting Jews and gypsies without good cause. Now we're going to go into our break already, so I'm going to check through here during the break and see what is most important for me to be telling you. I need about 5 hours. The music is the Swing Orchestra, the Golden Sieben, that was playing in Germany in the 19th. Thank you. Well, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, and this is Carolyn Yeager, and we're moving from this delightful, easygoing, happy swing music to this grisly subject that I'm talking about right now, which is shooting people. And the point of what I was saying before the break was that the way the Holocausters do it is they try to point out that it's always the part that's Jews or gypsies or something like that being shot. They leave out the other people. And Matonio says here that according to all of the information in these reports, when you look at it, even before Jews and gypsies were targeted, already 3,600 Serbs had been shot as reprisal measures. And this report of October 1941 informs that according to the order of General Böhme, for each shot soldier, 100, and for each injured soldier, 50 Serbs will be executed. And another place, 2,200 Serbs and Jews have been shot, in addition to 1,736 inhabitants of Kraljevo and 19 communist women. So Matonio says, therefore, it is very simple-minded and deceptive to state that Jews and gypsies were shot in lieu of Serb partisans, which is what they're trying to argue, that there are a lot of Serb partisans, but they were grabbing Jews and shooting them instead of the Serbs. Now, how is that going to even accomplish anything? I wouldn't then stop the Serb partisans or make them think twice, or wouldn't get rid of them either. So this is how this argument goes, that it's always that trying to prove a plan to exterminate all Jews from the information that's available, when actually it's true that there was a lot of killing and shooting going on, but it was because this partisan warfare was vicious. It was vicious, and it was decimating, and not only decimating German troops, but it was doing a lot of harm to their infrastructure and, you know, to their supply routes, their supply trains, and so on. Bringing supplies in to the soldiers and all of the things that it was very damaging, and they had to deal with it, and they were dealing with it. And that's the way it goes. It's just as I said in the beginning, there were two wars going on. Because I didn't want to lose my place, I couldn't really go down because I knew I'd never get back again, move down. I've got, so I'm going to have to just move through this. I don't know why I think I can read a lot in 2 hours, but it just doesn't amount to too much. So I'm probably going to skip. There's some real good stuff here. Looking for a place to kind of start. It's all similar. Here's a what is this book? Browning, this Christopher Browning wrote, the decision was made whilst, this is Losa. We haven't talked about him, but he's a German, part of the German scenario here. He was visiting Berlin for 2 weeks. The fact that Long told Losa that essential work on the camps had not yet commenced and that other arrangements could be made if the camps were not ready. Other arrangements, according to the Holocausters, were code for shooting or for the gassing device that they said was being used, according to Wetzel's draft of October 25th. And Browning, this comes from reference from Browning's book, Origins of the Final Solution. Therefore, Browning claims that the alleged decision to kill some German Jews deported to RK Ostland east, the east, into the east, was arrived at before the fateful general extermination order. That is, okay, repeat this. Browning claims the decision to kill some German Jews was arrived at before the fateful general extermination order. And this is what they're trying to say here with these local exterminations, that there were a lot of big and large numbers of Jews killed in local extermination centers, and in some cases gassed, they mean, before the order from Hitler, and to do it in these special extermination centers. But of course, the date of these special extermination centers, meaning Belzec, Sobibor, and Treblinka, were don't quite fit in with, you know, when they were wanted to bring in this exterminating. So that's one reason why they say that. But in some cases, they say they were doing it in these other places when the extermination centers were there and ready. So it's all, it, you know, none of it really makes a lot of sense. But here, I'll try to get the important part here. Footnote 90 appears at the end of this quotation. It's, so he said, Metonio says, only by an impressive leap of the imagination can Harrison infer from this quotation an extermination decision. Again, they're trying to get this extermination decision that never really happened. And they're talking about the Kaunas killing site and how many Jews were killed, and they've got these numbers and so on. In November, we're still in 1981. Well, I'm moving over to the regular PDF now, and I'm going to continue here because I thought this was good. Now, caption. How much is this? I've got this. I've got something else here that I came up from the killing of Soviet Jews. It's pretty good. Another chapter. So I'll see how I do with this and then come back and try to get that in. We've got Metonio says, I already observed above, Harrison gives the impression of not knowing the German text of the Jaeger Report, of which he quotes only passages of English translations available on the web. This is another thing he does. He finds everything on the internet. And some of these pages, they're just these Holohoax pages and things like here he found this excerpt. He quotes from the website Holocaust Education and Archive Research Team. And he uses these things, you know, and you can't be, you know, they're not reliable because, you know, you have to go to the original report and be able to read it so that you can know if the stuff they're posting on these sites is reliable. Metonio translates it and says the first five transports, which were supposed to go to Riga, we're talking now about the Baltic countries and what was going on there, were directed to Kauen. The camp in Riga, which is to accommodate about 25,000 Jews, is currently under construction and will be finished shortly. Meanwhile, the higher SS and police leader in Riga, Jaeglin, has initiated a shooting action, and on Sunday, about 4,000 Jews from the Riga ghetto and an evacuation transport from the Reich were disposed of. The action was originally to have been carried out by the higher SS and police leaders' own forces, but after a few hours, the 20 men of Einsatzkommando II, who had been detached for security purposes, were nevertheless employed in the action. While ignoring the question of the authenticity of the Jaeger report, it must be noted that two shootings in Kauen are mentioned here, which involved the five transports of Jews sent to this location from the Reich, that is, from Berlin. He gives the dates and so on. In total, 4,934 persons. The event report, number 151, on the other hand, speaks of the shooting of approximately 4,000 people from the Riga ghetto and an evacuation transport. So there's both some shooting and there's an evacuation. I add that neither the Yeager Report nor Event Report number 151 give any reasons for these executions. Another report does not mention the shooting of Reich Jews in Kaunas. On the contrary, as already mentioned, a subsequent report dated 3 July 1942 expressly says that from the Reich, 25,103 Jews were evacuated in 25 transports to Riga and accommodated there in camps or in ghettos. Therefore, these shootings in Kaunas remain to be ascertained, Matonio says. And, oh boy, there's a lot here, stuff about the Wannsee Conference, which I'm going to skip because, you know, Matonio takes the Wannsee Conference protocol as genuine. And his point is that it shows that they had an evacuation plan, that the plan, that the final solution plan was to remove the Jews from Europe. And, you know, they had a great, I don't know if I have that here, or that was somewhere else, but they when they were working out this idea for Madagascar, I don't know if I mentioned this last Saturday or not, they had a very solid idea of how to do that. And, of course, it was going to, the Jews were going to, that was going to be the Jews' own land there. They're all going to be there. And they were going to run things the way they wanted and do things the way they wanted. But they weren't going to be there alone, because if so, they would have been leaving there all the time. So they were, it was going to be overseen by the SS. And there would be an SS you know, leader there or whatever, in a whole bureaucracy there. But they weren't going to interfere with what the Jews were doing. They were just going to make sure that they stayed there. And that, I suppose, maybe the wrong kind of messages and so on didn't get through to them, and think there wasn't any, you know, secret communication going on with the outside world and so on. But they couldn't do that. They didn't have time, and then they needed to do something about them. So then they did decide to get all the Jews out of Europe before the war, not wait until the war was over. Do it right now. And, oh, I know what I have here. Some great stuff here. Where is it? Is it where Hitler is talking? I'm going to go right on now to this chapter 5-9, Killing of Soviet Jews. Page 427, and see if this is here, and if not, then I'll have to find it in, no, I went too far, in, on the PDF. He starts out, or at least part of it, I quote a passage of Himmler's order of 27 October 1942. The operational headquarters of the Wehrmacht informs me that the Brest-Gomel stretch suffers increasingly from bandit attacks. And now this is Himmler, supposedly, and that the supplies for the fighting troops are therefore in jeopardy. Based on the communications available to me, the ghetto in Pinsk has to be viewed as the center of the entire bandit movement in the Pripyat marshes. I order you, now Pinsk, you know, that's in Russia, that's all that northeastern Russia area, I guess you'd call it northeastern, therefore I order you, despite existing economic objections, to immediately crush and annihilate the ghetto in Pinsk. If the operation allows it, 1,000 male workers are to be secured and assigned to the Wehrmacht for the construction of the wooden barracks. The work of these 1,000 workers may only take place in a closed and securely guarded camp. If surveillance of it cannot be guaranteed, then these 1,000 have to be annihilated as well. Pretty serious talk. This demonstrates, Matonio says, that the destruction of the ghetto was due to military considerations and not the result of an extermination policy of Jews for being Jews. This shows further that no general extermination order against all Jews existed, because in this case the inhabitants of the Pinsk ghetto, as those in all other ghettos, including several existing until 1944, would have been killed earlier, unless Himmler had ordered an exemption for each ghetto, which would have to be proven. Finally, we find here a demonstration of the fact that when physical elimination was actually ordered, Himmler did it openly, as is also the case in many of the Einsatzgruppen reports. It was all, you know, out in the open. The source adduced by Harrison is Helmut Heiber, a Reichsfuhrer. He was a Reichsfuhrer. The information about it. The real source is, but he says that's not the real source. The real source is, in fact, the website Jewish Gen. You know, that's that Ancestry website, on which the translation of the document in question appears, which Harrison modified in order to hide the plagiarism. You know, he's always plagiarizing things. What Matonio calls it plagiarism. It's something he wouldn't do. It's just taking stuff from other people and not really giving them the proper credit for it. I quote this text indicating with square brackets a correction made by him. Well, he just shows how, you know, this is just showing how Harrison took it from here. He made a few changes in order to make it not appear that he had taken it directly from this Jewish Gen site. Okay. Going on, in his conclusion, Harrison writes, the flaws in MGK's writing. Now, this is more about where Matonio is, you know, defending himself from Harrison's attacks on his character. And, you know, he says that Matonio uses self-contradiction, irrelevancy, highly selective sourcing, and distortion. And Matonio says he then lists again his long catalog of impostures and tampering. I amply demonstrated that these are in fact the characteristics of Harrison's own response, in addition to a high dose of hypocrisy and bad faith, not to mention pilfering of the sources of others, which only testifies to his documentary ignorance. That's the kind of stuff that goes on here and there. Anyway, we go now to chapter 6, AR in context of Jewish policy. Action Reinhardt in context of National Socialist Jewish Policy, page 430. Yeah, I was reading today. I found something good there. I'm going to move on to him, to here. He says, this event shows the actual significance of the radicalization. The Eastern Jews found themselves in the theater of military operation. The measures of extermination undertaken against them were for the purpose of protecting the Wehrmacht from what the Germans considered a threat. As for the number of victims we witness here, the sadomasochism typical of preening denouncers of Nazi crimes, they exaggerate. And he says they seem to derive satisfaction from inflating death tolls. And one may ask, in what manner did the eyewitnesses draw up their guesstimates? Well, you know, if this has been said about the Jews in general, that they want to have as many victims, Jewish victims, of the National Socialists as possible. And they want to have as many Jewish victims from anybody and everybody as possible. That's how they deal with their agenda. You know, but people have pointed out that why do they want to have more and more and more deaths, as many deaths as possible, when it's pointed out often that, gee, this many people didn't die and this many people weren't killed. And instead of being happy about that and wanting to find that out, they don't want to find it out, and they get very angry when anybody says so. Now, this is about Goebbels' diary from chapter 6, page 557. On March 2nd, 1943, Goebbels noted in his diary that it was perfectly clear as to what would threaten us if we were to become weak in this war, especially in the Jewish question. We are so determined that there is no way back, and that's a good thing. A movement and a people which have burnt its bridges behind itself fights according to experience more unconditionally than those who still have the possibility of retreat. Well, he got that idea probably from Hitler. For Hitler had made very similar comments. I'm just going to jump down here because that's just kind of repetition. This shows that this quotation does not necessarily bear a relation to the alleged Jewish extermination. Terry continues, Hitler similarly informed the Romanian dictator Marshal Antonescu on April 16, 1943, that he, quote, preferred to burn all bridges behind himself, as the hatred of the Jews was gigantic anyway. There was no going back on this path once it was chosen, said Hitler. This source, quoted by Nick Terry, is Hillgruber, and it gives he's the diplomat. Evans reports, now Richard Evans, the historian, reports the German text of the passage from which Terry's quotation is extrapolated. It's translated. This is a translation of the German text. The Führer then, this is Richard Evans, the Führer then described the measure which had been taken in this regard in Germany. At the very moment when the Jews were removed, this is what Hitler had said, a boom occurred in the economy, in the cultural life, and in other areas. In other countries in which the Jewish question was tackled less energetically, as for example in Hungary, the conditions are very difficult. The Jews are the natural allies of Bolshevism and the candidates for the positions which are currently occupied by the intelligentsia slated to be murdered within the Bolshevization. Therefore, the Führer sustains the opinion, in contrast to Marshal Antonescu, that one has to proceed against the Jews the more radically the better. He, the Führer, would rather burn all bridges behind him, because the Jewish hatred is tremendous anyway. In Germany, there is, as a consequence of the resolution of the Jewish question, a united nation without opposition. However, there is also no way back once the path has been taken. The source is Evans. The source given by Evans is the same Hillgruber in Staatsmänner und Diplomaten, BEI Hitler. And Antonio says this text is perfectly consistent with a policy comprised by the removal of the Jews, a radical solution in contrast to that adopted by other European countries, which limited themselves to racial legislation. He is saying that Hitler's policy and his belief was that if you limited yourself to racial legislation, you weren't going to have as good a result in your own country as if you get rid of the Jews entirely. And he says that's what's necessary for us to thrive in Europe. And Terry reproduces a long quotation of statements made by Hitler during a meeting with the Hungarian leader Horthy, for which he provides no date, but Matonio says they date to 17 April 1943. And again, the sources is Hillgruber in the book in the document that I mentioned, Staatsmänner und Diplomaten. But this text was taken instead from Evans' expert report. And it says, this is supposedly Hitler speaking. He's speaking to Horthy. Where the Jews were left to themselves, as for example, I don't know if this is Hitler speaking or if this is Evans saying what Hitler said, but where the Jews were left to themselves, as for example in Poland, gruesome poverty and degeneracy had ruled. They were just pure parasites. One had fundamentally cleared up this state of affairs in Poland. If the Jews there didn't want to work, they were shot. If they couldn't work, they had to perish. They had to be treated like tuberculosis bacilli from which a healthy body could be infected. That was not cruel if one remembered that every, even innocent natural creatures, like hares and deer, had to be killed so that no harm was caused, like when they overpopulated. Why should one spare the beasts who wanted to bring us, Bolshevism more than we would spare the innocent animals? Nations who did not rid themselves of Jews perished. This is the end of the quote. This Evans gets this again from Hillgruber. He just keeps going on with this. This led Terry to plagiarize, okay, we're not, this citation, even though the bulk of the text of his quotation appears on page 257. He's just criticizing Terry's use of his sources. So he says, Matonio asked, did Hitler really confess to Horthy the alleged extermination of the Jews? The documentary context allows us to exclude this possibility. He says no. I will begin by pointing out that Evans' translation of the verb verkommen as perished is a forced one, something to which I will return in detail below. The abbreviation ADAP stands for Akten zur Deutschen something Politik. And in the source in question, the passage quoted by Terry is given, albeit incompletely, as an editor's footnote in the context of the meeting between Hitler and Horthy on 16 April 1943, the subject of which was the struggle against Bolshevism. David Irving writes that, according to the manservant's register, Hitler saw Horthy three times, at 5:30 p.m. on April 16th and at 12:10 and 5 p.m. on the 17th. Three corresponding records exist by interpreter Paul Schmidt, as both Horthy and Schmidt claim in their memoirs that Schmidt was absent during the first meeting. It is probable that, as in 1944, the conference room at Klesheim was bugged with hidden microphones. During the April 16th, that's the end of the Irving quote. Matonio continues, during the April 16th meeting, Hitler stated that his allies were not sufficiently motivated to conduct the fight in a radical way, and that he thought about having their troops removed from the front. He also rebuked Horthy for the approaches made in Bern, Switzerland, by various Hungarian personalities to the British and Americans with the obvious aim of concluding a separate peace. Now, this was in 44. Yeah, I guess. The internal policy of the Hungarian government was causing a gradual decay of their soldiers' morale at the front. To Hitler, Horthy's philo-Semitism was incomprehensible, while declaring that he did not want to meddle in the internal affairs of Hungary. Hitler stated, quote, today Germany stands with its morale consolidated because it has removed the Jews, even the last of whom will soon have vanished to the east. Difficulties like those which Germany had experienced due to the Jewish influence in 1918 could now no longer arise. If the Jews were not driven out, they would again, just as then, destroy the economy, the currency, and the morale. The Duce and Antonescu of Romania had completely accepted this. Unquote. Horthy dismissed the approaches to the Allies as, now this is Matonio, as having been made without the consent of the Hungarian government. He drew Hitler's attention to the fact that the solution of the Jewish question in Hungary presented considerable difficulties with regard to the number of the Jews, as well as their economic position in the country, while pointing also to the anti-Jewish measures already adopted. He said, quote, he had done everything one decently could against the Jews, but one couldn't very well murder them or bump them off somehow. This might be the translator, Schmidt. I think that's who this is from. The Führer replied that there was no need for that either. empty. Like Slovakia, Hungary could accommodate them in concentration camps. If there was talk of murdering Jews, then he, the Führer, must point out that only one person murdered, namely the Jew, who incited wars and who by his influence had given these wars their present character as wars waged against civilians, women, and children. With regard to the Jews, there was always the possibility of having them work in the mines. At all costs, however, they would have to be cut off from any kind of influence on their host country. Isn't that good? That's really good. You know, I mean, Hitler saw the picture. He saw everything so clearly all the time. Matolio goes on, in an attempt to refute Hitler's affirmation that an extermination of Hungarian Jews would be unnecessary, the ADAP editors present in their footnote number 15, two passages from the conversation between Hitler and Horthy of 17 April 1943, the first of which is that quoted by Terry, the second being a statement of the Reich's Außenminister, that is Ribbentrop, which goes unmentioned by Terry. Another proof that his claims of using ADAP as a source amounts to mere plagiarism. In the conversation on 17 April, Hitler returned to the Jewish question, introducing into the discussion the subject of food rationing measures. In Germany, these were implemented according to orders given, and no black market existed. You know, the Germans were able to have an uncorruptible government, especially the National Socialists were. These other countries that he was dealing with were never able to do that and still aren't able to do that. You know, we know that in the Balkan countries and some of the Slavic countries, there's corruption is so rampant, it's very hard to control, to stop people from. But Hitler said that they didn't have it in his Germany. Horthy admitted that there were severe problems in Hungary with regard to this issue, in particular because the government was unable to control the black market. Hitler replied that this was the fault of the Jews. On this follows Ribbentrop's hardball reply adduced by the ADAP editors. Now, you know, they've got people editing this who aren't, who are trying to show something else. But this quote is, to Horthy's counter question as to what he should do with the Jews now that he had deprived them of almost all possibilities of livelihood. After all, he could not kill them off. He said, I'm sorry, I'm yawning. The Reich foreign minister declared that the Jews must either be exterminated or taken to concentration camps. There was no other possibility. Well, you see, they make this out to be that, well, the Ribbentrop said they must be exterminated or taken, as though they, you know, as though that was one of the options. Whereas, Matonia is going to make the argument that, that they're saying that they can be taken to concentration camps. And if not, they have to be exterminated. So, you know, the thing is, you know, put them in concentration camps. He's saying there's no other possibility. You couldn't just leave them out. You couldn't leave them running around. You couldn't leave them loose. This is what Hitler's argument is, saying how much damage they always did in Germany and how they're not doing that kind of damage now and how much better it is. Even the people's morale is so much higher and so on. And in response to Horthy's observation that Germany had it easier in this respect, that Horthy, since it did not have so many Jews, and it's true, Hungary had an awful lot of them, Hitler quoted figures showing the extraordinarily great predominance of Jews in certain professions in Germany, figures which were unknown to Horthy. Hitler went on citing the case of two adjacent German cities, Nuremberg, which for 400 years had been free of Jews and flourished, and Fürth, which had welcomed them and degenerated completely. Hitler's discussion of the treatment of the Jews concludes with the following passage, part of which is quoted by Terry. Only part of this is quoted by Terry. Quote, the Jews, this is Hitler, supposedly, the Jews did not even possess organizational value. In spite of the fears which he, the Führer, had heard repeatedly in Germany as well, everything continued to go its normal way, even without the Jews. Now, this is, I shouldn't say this is Schmidt, his notes of the meeting, because he was the translator between the two. Where the Jews were left to themselves, Hitler had said, as for instance in Poland, the most terrible misery and degeneration prevailed. They are just pure parasites. In Poland, this state of affairs had been thoroughly cleared up. If the Jews there refused to work, they were shot. We've read this already. If they could not work, they had to degenerate. We read this about the hares and the deer. Why should the beast... Why should the beasts who wanted to bring us Bolshevism be spared more? Nations who did not resist the Jews degenerated. Then here's the sentence that was left out. One of the most famous examples of this was the decline of a people who were once so proud, the Persians, who now lead a pitiful existence as Armenians. The bloggers decided to leave that sentence out. To summarize, on 16 April, Matonio says, Horthy told Hitler that Hungary had taken every possible measure against the Jews and that it could not kill them. To which Hitler replied that this was not necessary anyway, since they could be detained in concentration camps, as had been done in Slovakia. Because Horthy did not want to exterminate them, he should not hesitate to intern them. As Horthy was reluctant to adopt this measure, Ribbentrop admonished him that, you know, you have only two options, to exterminate them or put them in camps. In this context, Hitler stressed the need to bring the Jews under control. For this purpose, as stated by him the previous day, it was not necessary to exterminate them, but instead to put them in concentration camps. Left to themselves, the Jews constituted an element of disintegration, as demonstrated by the case of Forth and versus Nuremberg. A further example brought up by Hitler during the meeting was the case of Poland, where the Jews who refused to work were shot, while those unable to work had to verkommen. That's the German word he used. That is to degenerate, to go to ruin, decline. This did not mean that they were to be exterminated. See, he didn't, the word he used doesn't mean exterminated, as is shown by the second last sentence, which contains the same verb in a similar context, which was nations who did not resist the Jews degenerated, and he used the word verkommen there. So in both cases, it would have been the same meaning for him as in the same same little speech he was giving. Hitler then gave an example of this fate about the Persians, who, because of the Jews, are now the pitiable Armenians. So he says, Matonio says, it must also be stressed that Hitler stated that among the Jews left to themselves, as those of Poland, there reigned the most terrible misery and decay, and he used the word verkommenheit for decay. So there again, he's using that word, you know, verkommen is not in the meaning of to exterminate. The noun verkommenheit is derived from the verb verkommen, he says. I already told you that. It here serves as further confirmation that Hitler in this context, did not use verkommen in the sense of to perish, which would be unkommen in German. His comment that non-working Jews had to verkommen thus simply implies a course of isolation. The comparison of the Jews to bacilli of various diseases infecting a healthy body, fostering subversion and instilling defeatism in the host population, if accorded the opportunity, is a well-known rhetorical device of Hitler, as is the comparison with pests. Continued on page 564. Well, I'm saying where I can go and continue reading about this, but But I'm going to go back to where I was before I went into this, these last two chapters, taking a little bit from there, and see what I can find here. Now let's see, if I go back up here, I can see what page this ends at. 332 to 348, I'm on page 3. Okay, let me go down a little bit. I'm really moving around here. 373, no, it's too far. There's a summing up. Page 354. That's too far. Page 305. Okay, let's see what we got here. We've got talking about Gerlach and Eichmann and Globok. I may have already covered this, or it might be more, but it was a lot of back and forth about all that, which gets too tedious to read it on the radio. Let's see, though. Maybe I should just go to this summing up. Page 348 and 349. Wow. I got a long way to go. How did I get way up here? Okay. Sorry, folks. It always ends up like this. It's so difficult. I'm just going to go ahead and go there. At least I know what's there. Oh, they're talking about Minsk and stuff. Alright. See where this starts. Well, I'm at 348. So, this is supposed to be a summing up. I will start from the end. Okay, I will start from the end, Matonio says. I mentioned the document in question, in a section titled Direct Transports of Jews to the Eastern Territories. Kube's threats, as I showed above, Kube was one who was he had an important position, and he was frustrated with having these Jews and not being able to, not having any place to put them, and not being able to do anything about them, and he was trying to get permission to send them somewhere, and everywhere he wanted to send them, they said no, he couldn't send them there, and then they didn't have the transportation available for a while, and he was, I forget now all the things that he was complaining about, but he was complaining, and he didn't seem to be punished for it. But Matonio says, his threats did not refute the deportation policy to the east. He was threatening to kill all these Jews. I will return presently to this essential topic. For what concerns the alleged mass of evidence, I have amply demonstrated that it is Harrison who systematically distorts reality in order to create a case which, starting with the alleged Führer order of December 1941 through the unproven gas bans, tries to explain and solve from a historiographical point of view the serious problem of the gas chambers. Let me go real quick over to my site page, see if I'm still on the air here. Okay. The basic problem is whether executions of Jews were performed in Serbia and in the Reichskommissariat White Ruthenia based on a specific extermination order of Jews for being Jews. I do not, in parentheses, he says, I do not consider Helm, no, because Harrison did not adduce any evidence of killings in this camp. Parentheses. This problem remains unsolved also in the most recent Orthodox Holocaust historiography. If, as Gerlach states, the decision to exterminate the Jews in Europe must have been made after December 7th and before December 14th, 1941, can you imagine these people are trying to pinpoint it like that. Then the evacuation transports from the Reich territory to the east after this period were doomed for extermination based on this order, and any of the alleged local ad hoc or official extermination centers, Chelmno, Belzec, Sobibor, Sorry, I was saying Sobibor. I get mixed up sometimes whether there's an R there or not. Sobibor, Treblinka, Auschwitz, and also Majdanek would have been the locations to implement this order. Nonetheless, many Jewish transports were directed past these centers toward the east, even after the opening of the alleged extermination camps, as I observed in our study about Sobibor. Now, there's a quote here, probably from his study, about his study in from the Sobibor book. Besides the transports to the Lublin district between 5 May and 28 November 1942, a full 36 transports of Western Jews, over 35,000 persons, were deported into the localities in the Eastern Territories mentioned previously, bypassing completely the three alleged extermination camps of Belzec, Sobibor, and Treblinka. The 124 transports, which went from Vienna to Minsk between 16 May and 28 November 1942, followed the line Vienna, Lundenburg, Lundenburg, Perau, skirting Auschwitz to the west via Opeln and Częstochowa towards Warsaw, with some of them going on to Minsk via Bialystok. To do that, they passed through Malkinia, some 4 kilometers from the extermination camp at Treblinka. Some other transports proceeded via Siedlce, Polish names, and thus came as close as 80 kilometers to Treblinka and 140 kilometers to Sobibor. In the train schedule order number 40 of the German Railway Administration located at Minsk, we can read, according, this is a quote from the train schedule, according to an announcement, in a train schedule order, announcement by the RBD, Reichsbahn Direktion, Imperial Rail Administration, Königsberg, in Königsberg, there will be a weekly special train with about 1,000 persons from Vienna via Bialystok and Baranowicz to Minsk freight station, having the following schedule. And it gives a schedule where they're going. And they're in every case, they're bypassing these camps. They're taking the people somewhere else. Why would one want to make a detour of some 300 kilometers around three extermination camps with train loads of Jews destined to be killed? Matonio asked in his book Sobibor. Another event which is inexplicable from the mainstream Holocaust point of view has been noted by Jules Shelvis. Quote, the intriguing question is why, in the spring and summer of 1943, the transports from Western Europe headed for Sobibor, rather than Auschwitz-Birkenau, which was, in fact, closer. I didn't read that quite right with the emphasis. The transports that were headed for Sobibor, rather than Auschwitz-Birkenau in the spring and summer of 1943. The transports from Westerbork ran along the line, Breslau, Open, goes on, going south from Częstochowa along the line, it gives a bunch of towns. The Auschwitz camp is only some 100 kilometers away. Instead, the transport went east, another 400 kilometers to reach Sobibor. All right, if the goal of the deportations to the east was extermination, then why were these Jews not directed to the nearest and best equipped extermination camps? That's the end of 5.7. And then it goes to the Europe-wide final solution. I'm not going to read any of that. I'm going to go back here to and see. I'd like to point out that everyone has to ask themselves whether the shooting of large numbers of Jews and non-Jews who, because of the partisan activity, and some of it was because they were discovered to be partisans and were executed, and some of it was reprisals. So it can't be certain that all of the people who were shot in reprisal were active in the partisan movement, but that would have been the intention, that's the people they would have gotten, but you can't be certain that some didn't get in there that weren't. Whether that is justified in wartime, considering the situation that the Wehrmacht was facing when it went into the Soviet Union. Apart from the question of whether they had any right to do so, and we do know, I mean, that's a whole other issue, but it was self-defense, it was preemption of the invasion by the Soviet Union into Germany that was planned very, very shortly. So Germany did as well as it did because the Soviet Union was preparing for an offensive and had all this war material and planes and tanks and what have you and so on, all up there close to the border. And that's why when the Wehrmacht went in there and they were able to just bomb all that stuff, all the pieces, and capture a lot of it, you know, and captured all these troops that were there and so on, waiting for their order to take on their offensive, and they weren't prepared at all for defense. So they had no positions or anything prepared for defense, and that's why the Germans were so successful in the beginning, because that attack was just the right thing, you know, for them to do. But then they had, you know, all these peasants there, but it was basically, as it's been stated again and again in a lot of places, basically Jews were the most active in the partisan anti-German guerrilla warfare. And I found a lot of evidence of that just looking around, looking for stuff, you know, the last couple of days. But I'm not an expert on it. But so, you know, this was, and when the Germans talk about it, they say, well, they bring the Bolshevik infection. They bring Bolshevism to Europe, and we can't allow that. We have to get rid of that. And the Jews are always bad for not only Bolshevism but everything else they do, and so we have to get them out. And this was the rationale. If you think like the Holocaust believers and these Jews, now, did I ever mention, I think most of you probably know, that all five of these bloggers at Holocaust Controversies are Jewish. And I think Christopher Browning is Jewish, and I'm not sure if Christian Gerlach is Jewish or not. He might not be. I don't know. I forgot to look. But most of the people who write Holocaust, most Holocaust historians and so on and so forth, are Jewish. And now I'm positive that this Wendy Lauer is Jewish. One way or another, she is. If she's only part Jewish or she's all Jewish, it doesn't matter, you know, what she looks like. You wouldn't peg her for being Jewish when you saw her. But, you know, so they have their ulterior motives behind what they're doing. And now I lost my thread there, but they, if you think that that they have just cause, you know, that in spite of what Jews are known to be and do, and in spite of that, as Hitler said, when the Jews were welcome in a place, it deteriorated and went to hell, and when they were not allowed in, it was doing very well, you know, thriving, and everybody was happy there. So, you know, these are facts, which the Jews, of course, deny. They just deny it. And I don't know how they get around all that, but they call it anti-Semitism. And, you know, it's said because of anti-Semitism, not because it's true and so on. So it comes down to a battle, as I've brought up before. And, you know, I like to talk about the arguments that the revisionists have, but it comes down to a battle between Jews and non-Jews is what it comes down to.
and whether they can cohabitate and live together. And it's mostly the Jews who think that they're a wonderful advantage in non-Jewish countries. And they've convinced many non-Jews that they are, and that the way they do things makes life better for us. But look at talking about the Nuremberg and Forth and the difference between having Jews and not having Jews. Look at the United States of America. It has become totally Judaized. It's filled with Jews. Jews run it. I don't care what you say that they're not all Jews. Jews are behind everything that's done. And look at, we're going to hell. Look at what's happening. We're so far in debt. They've brought us into all this, you know, debt, and hundreds of trillions and so on. And here we are facing true decay. And it's because of the Jews that are here. So that's the end of what I'm going to do on this chapter. And I might do some more from this book on this coming Monday. Because there's a lot more to go into, and we haven't even touched on Thomas Kuhn's work on the resettlement of Jews in the East. So I'll thank you for listening tonight, and I will see you next time.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.